Hello, Catskills. Welcome to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
I'm Julia Reichel. I'm the publisher of the Watershed Post.
I'm Lissa Harris, and I'm the editor.
The Watershed Post is a news hub, a bracing antidote to the idea that nothing ever happens in the Catskills.
And here's what we've got for you today.
First of all, I want to let everyone know that our guest today was going to be Michelle McNaught, an amazing 22-year-old Delancey native who is an accomplished artist and who was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer a year ago and has been heroically battling it ever since. Michelle is not feeling good today, so we are postponing our chat with her, but we're going to be talking about her upcoming show at a Manhattan gallery and her artwork, which is a response to her trial with chemotherapy and treatment in the past year. It's
some
amazing stuff.
Really amazing pieces. So if you're in the vicinity of Manhattan at that time.
Yeah, there's also a book.
She has a book.
Her work compiled in a book, which has a foreword.
Which has a foreword right by another local fellow, Peter Sheldahl, who is, of course, the art critic for The New Yorker and lives in Bovina.
But we'll talk about that more a little later in the half hour.
First, this week's headlines, if I could try and stop interrupting Julia for a minute.
Hey, jumping the gun, Harris.
Yeah. So it goes. The deadline for applying for FEMA aid for individuals, which was supposed to be, I believe, this Monday, has been extended to December 15th. So you got an extra 2 weeks. If you haven't applied
extra
for
2 weeks.
Individual aid.
December 15th to, what was it?
It was going to be...
it was November 1st.
Excuse me.
It was October 31st.
Yes, 6 weeks. My brain is addled.
Yeah, 6 weeks. God.
An extra six weeks.
December's still 6 weeks away, thank goodness. Yeah. I was the one...
Well, it snowed. It's been snowing. So I'm thinking, you know... Winter is here.
Right, it's December, Christmas. Yes, I was the one who did these posts, and I did a post on Monday saying, okay, everybody, this is the last day, Halloween, you got to get your FEMA applications in.
Yeah. We thought we were being very on top of it by making sure that we had that deadline published, and then they went and changed it on us.
Yes, so at the last minute, it's actually an extra 6 weeks, which is great news, and I know a lot of locals have been advocating for that deadline to be extended.
And seriously, even if you think you're not going to get anything, it doesn't hurt to apply, and if you miss the deadline and that really is the deadline, then that's it. So
I know now we don't know. It'll be the deadline.
That'll really, really be the deadline.
Yes.
We're pretty sure. So get your applications into FEMA and
you can do it over the phone or online. And they take it both ways and they'll take it. I think the phone lines are available from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Something really broad.
You can always go to FEMA.gov and that will let you know.
So the number is 1-800-621-3362 to register. I just want to mention that. Okay, so other big stories this week. This is my favorite one from the past week. Wolves making a comeback in New York State. Lissa, you did a very wonky, science-y story about this.
It was so wonky and so science-y because I get really jazzed about this stuff. But it's actually not a really new story. But, you know, the machine of science goes very slowly. A wolf was shot in, I believe it was Saratoga County, about 10 years ago. And they had the... bones and the pelt of this wolf in storage. And a couple of scientists from the New York State Museum in Albany had a look at this and some other wolves that have been killed around the state to see if they were wild or domestic. And it turned out that the wolf that was killed in Saratoga County was indeed a wild wolf. At least that's what they determined.
This is the new study that
just came
out.
This is the new study. So it took them about 10 years to figure out that wolf that somebody shot out in a field somewhere was a wild wolf. But it was. And it was very ingenious how they did it. They look at the bones and they can tell whether the wolf has been eating mainly a diet that's typical of a domestic animal or whether it's been living in the wild. And the way that they do that is they look for a certain ratio of this carbon isotope that occurs in greater quantities in animals that have eaten a corn-based diet.
Right, corn is weird.
Corn is weird. Corn is one of about, I think it's 1% of plant species that is, it's called a C4 plant.
That means carbon-4.
Carbon-4. Ah. It's either plants are either C3 or C4. Most plants are C3. And what that means is that during photosynthesis, there's a molecule that they produce. And some of the plants have 3 carbons in this molecule, and some plants have a slightly different molecule that has 4 carbons.
What, aside from corn, does that?
I'm not sure what they all are. It's actually, it's evolved different times separately, independently of each other in the plant world, which means it's really, really useful. Like, you know.
To have four carbons.
Like eyes. Eyes evolved in different times in animal
history.
Flies
have eyes and mammals have eyes.
Yeah, and they're different kinds of eyes because it's really useful to have eyes. So the fact that something evolved independently in many different areas is a good clue that it's pretty useful.
Okay, find us back to the wolves here.
Find us back to the wolves here. So they eat this corn and then they have more of this carbon isotope because the C4 plants take up more of that particular isotope and they study the bones and it goes all the way through the food chain. This carbon isotope occurs in different ratios all the way up the food chain.
So they can tell by looking at the bones there's a higher concentration of C4 isotopes?
No. It gets even hairier than that because the isotope is called carbon-13 and it occurs in a greater frequency in C4 plants.
Okay. So what do they do when they look at the
bones?
And
if you're going to ask me more than that, then I'm going to get myself into trouble because I really don't have a chemistry degree.
Okay, so let's bring it back to the wolves. So they figure out, they do this study of the
bones. They figure out that the wolf is wild, that it has not been eating dog food. It's been eating wild critters and things and not a bunch of C4 plants or things that have eaten C4 plants. So they determine that it's wild. And this means that it's probably migrated in from somewhere where wolves are breeding naturally. They don't know that wolves are breeding in New York State, but they do feel pretty confident that there are wolves that are true wild wolves, not escaped from captivity, that are in the state.
So does this have any implications for conservation? I know that the wolf is protected, but if it's not around...
This is where it gets really cool and also really wonky, because this is where science meets politics.
Sounds horrible.
Well, there is some disagreement in the science world as to whether the gray wolf and a couple of other species, the eastern wolf and the red wolf, whether those are in fact really different species or not.
And so they don't know.
Because some scientists think that the eastern wolf should be called a subspecies of the gray wolf, mm-hmm. and some of them think it should be its own species. And the way that the conservation status works is that, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, basically determines, okay, this is the species and this is where its range is and this is where we're going to protect it. You know, they do all of this, these plans based on the scientific evidence for how to conserve things. So what the Fish and Wildlife Service has basically said, and this is pretty recently, is that they think that the eastern wolf is its own species, that the wolf that we had here in New York State and in and in the rest of the northeastern U.S. was the eastern wolf. It's not the gray wolf, and it's not the same species. And based on that, they want to remove the eastern half of the United States from the protected range of the gray wolf.
And what does that mean practically?
Practically, that means that the eastern wolf is its own species, that it's been extirpated here, and the gray wolf... it would be protected in its western range. But if any gray wolves migrated in from their western range to recolonize mm-hmm. New York State or some of the other eastern areas, that they wouldn't necessarily be protected because the government is saying that they are not native to New York State. Gray wolves are not native
to New
York State.
I found this is very confusing.
It's really confusing. And the scientists...
Wolves are either protected or they're not.
But it's you can't just say wolves.
Right.
Because there's different species involved. And to really shake things up, some researchers think that what we know of as coyotes... in the eastern U.S. actually
are really
have a
wolves.
Little, well, no, they're not really wolves, but they have a little bit of wolf in them.
I think that's so
There's
cool.
been a little bit of interbreeding, and these scientists also think that the red wolf is not a proper species, the eastern wolf is not a proper species. They're gray wolves with a little bit of coyote in them.
Okay, so those things that I hear howling outside my window.
Those are coyotes.
How do you know? You don't know.
Well, they sound like coyotes. No, those are coyotes. Wolves sound different than coyotes.
Oh, really?
She said authoritatively.
And a federal study to figure that out? No. I think this conversation just illustrates the point that figuring out what if a wolf is a wolf is very difficult.
I would welcome your wolf stories. If anybody has seen wolves in the Catskills
or cougars, we'll always listen cougars, to your cougar stories.
Yeah, we want to hear about it. Basically, this stuff is much less settled than you think it is. Yeah. It's kind of amazing how much debate there is about all this stuff, and how much the people who spend their lives studying it still don't agree on it. So it's cool.
Thank you. I really appreciate the sort of wonky look at that, because I do think
I hope other people did, because you know what? I could go on about this crap all day. So.
That was one of our most popular stories from the past week. People have told me, I love that wolf story.
It's great. It's kind of chilling to think that, you know, that wolves which were here a few hundred years ago, they were here in the forest, and to think of them being back and... It's kind of awe-inspiring and frightening and wonderful.
It makes me want to wear that wolf t-shirt I have from 8th grade all the time.
I think everyone had that wolf t-shirt from the 8th grade.
It was a cool t-shirt.
You kept yours, though.
Yeah, it should glow in the dark. That'd be really cool. All right, on to some other headlines for this week.
How about some more wildlife?
Are you talking about a certain goat infestation in
yes,
Kingston?
Yes, the Red Goats of Kingston.
That sounds like a band name.
It should be a band name. Get on it, Kingston.
Let me take a crack at this. Okay. I know you did the story, but so Kingston has recently experienced a giant graffiti wave, and the graffiti isn't just, you know, tagging the kind of thing you see someone's name or signature or something like that. No, they are stencils of goats. They're goat silhouettes, and they're red and they're spray painted on planters in the Uptown district of Kingston, which is supposed to be a very genteel, beautiful, perambulatory region, and it now has goats all over it. And now someone's also putting numbers on the goats.
There have been numbers put on the goats as well. So first the goats appeared, and then they got numbers. And it's
it sounds like something out of like an apocalyptic film. Like, is this the last?
It's kind of amazing. Sign? The goats have really taken on a life of their own. The place where they've appeared, these planters in Uptown Kingston, are part of what's called the Pike Plan. And this was the restoration.
Confused with the Pickens Plan, which is what I think.
No, the Pickens Plan is totally different.
It's about fracking.
No, it's about, well, sort of, about okay. natural gas. But anyway, goats have nothing to do with natural gas, to my knowledge, except they probably produce some of it. Anyway.
10 minutes in and you made a fart joke. Great.
This is what happens when you let me ramble.
Uphill from here.
Go on. No, but the goats, the Pike Plan was this effort to, which they have done, to restore these walkways, which if you've ever been to Uptown Kingston, there are these pedestrian walkways with these overhangs, like a wooden canopy and wooden planters, matching wooden planters that are put throughout the streets of Uptown Kingston. And... they were done, I think it was in the 60s, by a Woodstock artist whose last name was Pike, and hence the name the Pike Plan. But these were not popular with most of the business owners in Uptown Kingston, because they kind of make it hard to see the stores. It's just seen as sort of a waste.
So are the goats civil disobedience?
The goats may well be civil disobedience.
No
one knows who is responsible for the goats, but the city elected officials, some of them have gotten really upset about the goats and are blaming the goats on the people that are opposed to the Pike Plan. And
a goat is just a goat sometimes.
Sometimes a goat is just a goat. But the goats have a Facebook page now. It's called the Red Goats of Kingston.
How many likes do they have?
They have, I think, almost 500 people following them now. And they have gotten Kingston stirred up in this really amazing way. There's all this. They've become a flashpoint of civic participation and the target of official anger. I think Tom Hoffe said something about Bloods, Crips, Goats, it's all the same.
Who's Tom Hoffe?
He's an alderman in Kingston.
So he's saying Kingston basically politicos,
you know,
are getting in on
equating this. The goats with gang activity.
And oh my.
It's just incredible. You really should check out their Facebook page. and they've been giving out stencils now on the Facebook page, so you can make your own red goat and put it wherever you want to, as long as it's on your own private property.
So we do know who's in charge, the people behind the Facebook page.
Not
necessarily.
If they have
the goat stencils, that
must be. Not necessarily.
No,
because now they're putting them on t-shirts.
They're replica goat stencils.
People are putting, Uptown business owners are putting red goats on pieces of paper and sticking them in their shop windows.
Oh, wow.
They're making t-shirts. They're making it's the stickers.
Season. This is crazy. I didn't know the extent to which this has become.
No,
sort of
the
a
goats are now, but... you know, who knows who the original red goats were, but now there are many, many red goats. And they're saying on the Facebook page, the red goats are coming. The red goats are coming.
You're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour. And we are talking about this week's headlines. The next one that we have on tap is about a dog that saved a couple from a fire in Saugerties. Debbie Bunsha and Rick Gaylor narrowly escaped an early morning fire that destroyed their house on West Saugerties Road on October 27th. The hero of that story is Max, a 2-year-old German shepherd whose barking woke the couple and made sure they got out of the house before it was too late.
Go Max.
That's not the only dog rescue story we have this week.
Oh, that's true. That's true. So tell me about the other dog rescue story, Julia.
Okay, so I woke up on Saturday morning this week and I got a call about 8 a.m. from a frantic woman in Olive who told me this sort of incredible story about Ryan Owens, a 22-year-old man who had set off on a hike on Friday night last week in Olive, off of Moonha Road in West Shokan.
The woman that called you, Ryan lives in her house.
Yes,
right?
and he's sort of part of her extended family in some way and is very good friends with her son. So Ryan had left to hike up the mountain. He had some supplies with him and he had a dog, a golden lab named Maggie. And the two of them set off at about 1 p.m. Friday and did not come back and meet a friend who was going to pick them up at 5 p.m., and that really worried everybody. A search was begun at about 9 p.m. It took a couple hours for the authorities to be contacted because nobody could quite believe that he really wasn't on the road somewhere. So people were driving around looking for him themselves before they called the Stadies and the DEP.
So by the time you got the phone call...
It was the next day.
It was the next day. People had been looking out for Ryan in the woods
for 12
all night.
Hours.
And there was a tremendous snowstorm on the way, and everyone feared that this young man was dead in the woods or would soon be.
Yeah, there was actually quite a huge rescue effort launched, and I know that scores of people were combing the mountains. There was a helicopter dispatched. And this region is the Slide Mountain Wilderness in Ulster County, in Olive. It is one of the most impassable regions in the Catskills. It's one of the largest contiguous tracts of forest. Some of the old growth forest left over from tanning days is supposedly in this region. The Neversink Valley
A lot of the places where there's old growth is some of the most impassable spots,
yeah.
Because if it had been passable, they would have cut that stuff down.
Exactly. It's very rugged, very hard to get to. This young man was an accomplished hiker. It's not the first time he had hiked, but the initial report said that he was only out there with a jacket and a bottle of water and the dog.
Yeah, I think we heard later that he did have a backpack with him. But
backpack and maybe a topo map, a topographical map. But
still, so what happened? How did he get home?
So he did get home. That's the story. He hiked over 7 miles of this rugged, impassable wilderness with the dog. And overnight, he survived by staying in a cave. And presumably cuddling up with the golden lab. I mean, having...
If I had one, I would.
Oh, having another warm body with you is, I'm sure, the difference between life and death. I mean, that night was frigid. It was definitely below freezing.
He hiked all the way from Olive to Denning.
There was a huge search, and Donna Maurer, who was the woman who called me and told me about it in the first place, she was talking to a detective on Saturday around 1 p.m., and they were trying to figure out the next phase of the search. And she got a phone call. She got a cell phone call on her son's phone. She picked it up, and it was Ryan. It was the missing man. And he had knocked on the door in Denning, had been led into a house by the gentleman who lived there, and used the phone, called her up, and said, "I'm so sorry if I scared you, but I'm fine."
That's just incredible.
And it was reportedly just fine. The dog's fine.
You know, when we got that call that morning, I was thinking this just isn't going to end well, and you never want to report something like that.
It was awful. It was just very scary, and I know everybody in Olive was terrified. And to have a happy ending, the snow was just starting to fall.
And if you were up here last weekend, you know how much snow we ended up getting. That was a pretty incredible snowstorm.
Yeah, he was found just before it hit. So that was another happy dog story, which was really a pleasure to report. So we're glad about that.
Great. So... about that snowstorm, we got 5 to 10 inches across the weekend, and Governor Cuomo announced that let's see, 261,338 customers lost power statewide because of downed trees and power lines in the storm. And there was a state of emergency declared for 13 counties, including most of the Catskills counties, including Sullivan, Greene, Ulster, and Delaware counties. But Ulster County really got it the hardest, and they actually had shelters open in New Paltz and widespread power outages across the county.
I got an email from the Ulster County Emergency Services people this morning, and they said that the New Paltz shelter actually wasn't used very much. There were a couple people who used it last night, and it's being closed today because everybody has their power back
on. I'm glad to hear that.
But that, nonetheless, another huge wallop right after flooding, right after two bouts of flooding.
We really didn't need it, but it was, I have to say, it was really beautiful. It was kind of magical to wake up the next morning after that storm and see the snow on the ground. And we got some amazing photos from readers, both of the first little sprinkle of snow and then the second snowstorm, which we had put up on the website.
Yes.
So thanks to everybody who sent in your photos of the snowstorm.
So you're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour. I'm Julia Reichel, and with me is Alyssa Harris, the editor of the Watershed Post. We're going through our news headlines for this week, and we have a couple more for you. This is a happy one, sort of. Scientists have proven that the scourge that is killing bats nationwide is, in fact, a fungus, a cold-loving fungus, which is very strange to begin with, called Geomyces destructans, which, as it sounds, means it's a pretty bad virus, fungus. It's not a nice thing. The fungus creates a telltale white fuzz on the noses of hibernating bats, and it's known by its colloquial name as white nose syndrome. Bats across the country have been dying during hibernation because they starve to death. The fungus interferes with their ability to hibernate and use up their fat supplies properly.
Now, you said this was a happy story.
Sorry. I know.
It actually is. It's good news that they know for sure that it is this fungus. It was pretty well suspected that the fungus was responsible for the disease, and now it appears to be proven. So the more they know about it, the faster they can work on trying to see if there's something they can do about it. So that's a little bit of good news.
As that public announcement on TV goes, the more you know, it's a good start, but it's not great. I'm
and
sorry.
Knowing is half the battle.
Yes, right. That's Joe. From G.I. Joe. Good.
We had to cancel one of our town Meet the Candidates forums last weekend because of the snow in Shandaken, and that was we were sorry to do that, but we did sponsor a forum for the candidates for town supervisor in Woodstock on Friday, in which former town supervisor Jeremy Wilbur faced off against first-time candidate Lauren Rose at the Woodstock Community Center. That was moderated by Woodstock Times editor Brian Hollander, and we live blogged it.
We did.
As it was happening.
Yes, and
in real time.
I was there as the sponsor of the event on behalf of the Watershed Post, and it was there was some real minutia discussed. The town hall in Woodstock is apparently falling down. There was a lot of discussion of different individual columns that are rotting. Where people,
you know, it always sounds like little stuff unless it's your town.
Oh no, I think no. People in the audience clearly knew pretty much every timber.
I think at the
Andes building.
Forum, one of the main points of contention was how much does the dog catcher make?
So, too much, not enough. Difficult to say.
It always sounds little until it's your town. And,
yes.
And then it's big news. So
that's a good race in Woodstock. It's an interesting one. It would be tough to call right now, these two candidates. Really, nobody has a clear edge, and mm-hmm. they're pretty different, but they're both lifelong Woodstockers.
I think the race to watch is Middletown this election season.
Yeah,
four candidates, none of them endorsed by a political party. I think that's going to be some interesting stuff.
Yeah, popcorn, get it out. Next Tuesday, election night.
We may be hosting a radio show Tuesday night to call in the election results. We will keep you posted on that on the website.
Yes, if nothing else, we are going to be covering it 24 hours that night in many forms, I'm sure. One last headline. Occupy Wall Street spread to Delhi on Saturday at a pretty decently attended Occupy Delhi demonstration in Cortlandt Square.
A few dozen people there, which is pretty good for Delhi.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that Delhi is a college town, but most of the people at the protest did not look like college students. They were older local residents who were upset about foreclosures and the economic crisis and et cetera. Jess Vecchione, our filmmaker extraordinaire, went to interview some of them, and you can see her video on the Watershed Post. www.watershedpost.com.
This is the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour. We were going to interview Michelle McNaught, a Delancey artist who is battling stage 4 ovarian cancer extraordinarily today, but she could not make it. Instead, I want to read a quote from McNaught about her work. She's responded to a year of chemo and treatment, much of which has been very painful, with woodblock prints, etchings, and drawings of, there's one series of each of the 9 chemo drugs she's experienced, and there are these amazing sort of medieval looking woodcuts with,
they are sort of medieval, they look like they're almost like icons or like tarot cards, or like these, there's like these personifications of the drugs.
Yeah. And themselves. These drugs have such crazy names. They're like demons in some mm-hmm. way. I looked at it and thought, this is really a struggle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, epitomized.
It's a bit Albrecht Dürer. They're wonderful. They're wonderful. And you really need to see them. The radio isn't going to do them justice.
No.
But go, yeah, read that quote.
Okay. So this is from Michelle about why she's responded to cancer with this outpouring of artistic effort. Rather than see a therapist, I cope with my cancer and talk about my emotions and struggles through my work. It not only helps me sort out and heal certain things that I am struggling with, it also becomes a channel for me to explain to others how I'm handling the situation. The way I get to work with my hands and move materials around in order to create something that nobody has ever experienced before is fascinating. You get to play God in a sense, and you hope that the viewer does too. A professor of mine always says, sometimes you just have to rinse out your eyes, and it is so true. What a wonder things become when viewing them with a new set of eyes.
This is amazing. The show itself is happening from November 15th through 17th at the Leo Koenig Projecte. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right.
Leo Koenig Gallery.
Leo Koenig Gallery in Manhattan. That's 541 West 23rd Street in Manhattan. So if you have any reason to be in Manhattan that week, you should check out the show.
You're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour from WIOX 91.3 FM. There are a bunch of events this weekend, and the one I want to mention first is on Sunday. The band Detour and the rock and country band Country Express will play a huge flood benefit for the town of Middletown at Margaretville Central School from 1 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. Rob Lang, who's the frontman for Country Express, dreamed up the concert almost as soon as the floodwaters hit us, even before they receded. All proceeds will go to the Interfaith Council, which has been funding recovery projects in Middletown.
On Saturday, November 5th, the Shandaken Theatrical Society will host the second of 2 glitzy fundraisers at 8 p.m. Songs from the Silver Screen will feature renowned jazz cabaret duo Ann Osmond and Dennis Year, and Grammy-nominated writer-performer Robert Burke Warren, better known to us as Uncle Rock, for a show featuring an eclectic mix of memorable movie music spanning many decades and styles. That's November 5th, Saturday, at the Shandaken Theatrical Society.
And that same night, if you're feeling a little dark or Nosferatu-y, you could go.
If you're not done with Halloween yet.
Yes, if you're feeling undead, you should go to Kingston, where there will be the 7th annual Vampire Ball, which will be spinning goth and industrial dark tunes starting at 9 p.m. at the Basement on Broadway in Kingston and going, quote, until death. That's what they told us anyway.
Excellent. This Saturday, November 5th, is the Ulster County Trail Conference at SUNY New Paltz. That's all day from 8:30 to 4 o'clock p.m. with the Hudson River Valley Greenway, Ulster County, Barton and Logwadis, the Wallkill Valley Rail Trail Association, Scenic Hudson, and Gilmore Planning.
So these events and more are featured and are this weekend section at watershedpost.com/this weekend.
And that wraps up this week's edition of the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
The Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour originates from the studios of WIOX 91.3 FM in Roxbury, New York. Our technical guru is Mike Teitelbaum. Our theme music is by Fred Harris of Aleph & Company in Delhi. The cheesy banter and the wonky science facts are all ours. Please join us.
Facts belong to everyone, Julia.
No, they're mine. Please join us every Wednesday at 1 p.m. right here on WIOX 91.3 FM and at 3 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WatershedPost.com, the source for news and information in the Catskills.